Good evening and welcome to the studios of Yellowstone Public Radio here in Bozeman, Montana. I'm Susan DeCamp. Tonight's program is a recording of a panel discussion called The Inside Story, The Art, Craft, and Business of Filmmaking. It features a distinguished panel of filmmakers, most of whom are based right here in Montana. This hour of the discussion was held in Livingston, Montana, October 20th, 2001. Dennis Egg, professor in the film program at Montana State University, is the moderator.
I want to welcome everyone to the second part of the conference. Today is the Inside Story, the Art, Craft, and Business of Filmmaking, and we have a very distinguished panel of filmmakers to talk about it from various areas of the art, craft, and business. This two-day conference about film economic impact and the art and craft of production has been co-sponsored by the Montana Film Office, by the Laura Kahn Foundation, by the Livingston Depot Foundation, the MSU Bozeman Department of Media and Theater Arts, the Lincoln School Foundation, Diversified Innovations Group, and KUSM Montana PBS. And we want to give a special thank you to Lynette Dotson, who is the main coordinator on this, and Patrick Markey and Tyler Gaisford, who were with myself, Dennis Egg, part of the coordinating committee. We're going to start by, going around the table, my side of the table, and then I'll turn it over to my colleague Bill Neff from MSU to introduce his side. First, Tom Mickle, who is a producer of commercials and music videos with HKM Productions and has been shooting in Montana in the area since 1983. Scott Chestnut, who is an editor who's done many films, including Rounders, which I think many people are familiar with, and Red Rock West. Ron Judkins, who's won two Academy Awards for sound, also produced and directed The High Line, which is an independent feature shot up here several years ago. Jim Abel from Billings, who is a producer, director, and cinematographer. J.P. Gabriel, who is the head of Film Lights Montana, which I think is still called, and has a long record of experience in areas like grip and electric and things that a lot of people don't, at least not outside the industry, don't remember as part of filmmaking sometimes. Tom Miller, who is Livingston-based production, a video producer. John Buckland, who is a production designer. And Rick Rosenthal, who is a wildlife and outdoor and all kinds of cinematographer, and is also currently a visiting professor in the MSU MFA program in natural science filmmaking. I hope I got everything right. And Bill Neff, my colleague, is a director and filmmaker and is also a professor at Montana State.
On my left here, two gentlemen that have so many credits, I can't remember all of them, but they've made a few films, especially Michael Hausman, and my old friend Patrick Markey. And to my right is Tina Buckingham, producer and casting director. And next to her is Bob Erbinger, who is a cinematographer. And I don't know what Joe Camp does anymore, but now is directing. The last person there, but not least, some of his friends call him Gats, maybe some of your enemies too. William Yortzberg, who's a writer. 10 years ago when Dennis and I did this at the university, you would have seen part of it. But in those 10 years, things have changed so much in the filmmaking business that Coppola's suggestion or prediction that this little girl or young girl in Ohio would be making her own films, that prediction came true. And today our students are shooting on digital formats and are editing their films in their dorm rooms. And I'd like to ask some of the people on the panel what they think about some of the changes that have occurred in filmmaking, maybe due to digital revolution and to some other things that are happening.
I was going to say, this is one of the few times where we've had several cinematographers actually on a panel together. Usually no one lets them talk, and you know, and usually they don't want to talk. They tend to have a certain reputation. So I don't know, either Bob maybe or Jim or Rick, if one of you wants to respond to that. That's been one of the major changes, that instead of having to have a fairly large crew and big cameras and everything else, now people are doing even broadcast work with fairly small cameras.
the opportunity that comes out of all of that is available to so many of these kids. I'm surprised. I hear that 500 kids approximately are going through the MSU program right now, and those that stick with it are going to do something with it, and they're way ahead of me right now, a lot of them. So anyhow, the technology is such a great tool to allow you to be creative. You don't have to worry about many of the old technology problems that existed with video.
I'll comment a little bit on that. It's interesting. Yesterday we had had one of the major vendors and manufacturers, Sony, giving a workshop to our students. And we have 20 new students at Montana State now in this program. It's a graduate program, and it's not the film school. This is a separate program. But I think it's fantastic that this digital revolution is taking place. As a cinematographer, I've been fighting it and fighting it. And I love film, and I worked this summer with Super 35 up in Alaska on a program on whales, feature. And yet, when we look at some of the images, look at some of the results of high definition, it's something that's here. And I think that this film look is going to go away, and that the new audiences are going to accept these new formats and say, that is the look that we're after. I looked at some rushes last night that I shot in the Cook Islands on Super 16, and I thought to myself, I wonder how that would have looked in high definition. So we know that the benefits in post-production are just fantastic.
Bob Evinger?
I agree with what the other two participants are talking about, but I just read today in the local Bozeman Chronicle about some students, high school students from Bozeman and Belgrade, that were doing a project on losing the family farm. So we're having younger kids dealing with really important issues and being able to do it very inexpensively. This was being funded by a couple people that are in the film industry that live in that Bozeman area. I did a show in Turkey in June on DigiBetaCam, widescreen, and I was just amazed at the low light levels we were able to achieve with it. It was amazing. So the technology's there. I fought it. I came up with film. You know, we didn't even have video. I mean, that was news. And it's one of those things that it's been a hard transition for me because I've always liked the film look. But now with these new high-speed cameras, this stuff we were getting in Turkey was equivalent to anything I could shoot in Super 16.
Michael Hausman and Patrick Markey, both of you have done, you know, large features and a lot of independent films. Michael really was an independent producer before that term was there when he did Heartland and Alambrista. And he's also done things like Amadeus, all of Milos Forman's American films, and is just finishing Gangs of New York. He also is an adjunct, along with being at MSU Columbia, and has done a feature with his students that was shot in digital video. So, Michael, how do you see this affecting, you know, Hollywood and other sorts of dramatic films?
I think that, along with what Coppola said, Gene Cocteau said, that film will not be a great art until it's as cheap as pencil and paper. I'm amazed in the last 35 years I've been making movies, how few changes we've been able to come up with. We've gone to the moon, and we have wonderful technology, but in our own industry, there are very few things we've really done. Digital cameras is one. Non-linear editing is another. The HMI light, which is a small light that gives a lot of light power. Surround sound. And a few other things, but our business really has been locked into the technology. But the real thing for me is the script. If you have a good story, you can shoot it almost on anything. I mean, Heartland, we made in 1978 here in this state, and it was a landscape movie, and it was an important movie to do on 35. It was helpful. You could see it. Gangs of New York with Marty Scorsese, we made New York in Rome, Italy. Probably closer to $100 million. We could not have shot that on digital video. However, the film I just did before that with two of my Columbia students was a perfect little movie for digital video. But the essence for me in the film schools and those of you who own those small little cameras, don't shoot your movie until your story is interesting. Because I don't care what it looks like, all of that stuff falls away if you're not telling something that people care about. And particularly in these times, being a New Yorker myself, seeing the light at the end of the tunnel when you get older, you realize that you really have to pay attention to the story you're going to make, because people like ourselves at this panel will spend 1, 2, or 3 years making a movie, and let's make sure it makes sense what we're talking about.
Patrick?
I usually rely that if we hire a good cameraman or we hire a good sound man and the people that are sort of the technology whizzes on a set, they will know what to bring in the way of film stock and that sort of thing. I don't spend an inordinate amount of time as a producer understanding the minutiae of the technology. I'm much more concerned with the story. And there are a lot of bad stories being told every day because people have those cameras in their hands. And I don't know who the writer was, but there's a quote about something... this has to do more with writing than it does with filmmaking, but I think it's apropos about something that, to the effect that do you think that school writing programs stifle too many writers? And I think this writer responded by saying they don't stifle enough of them. And that's not to say to break people's spirits, but I do think people somehow become... charged with their own sense of being a filmmaker when they don't really understand the basic premise of storytelling. And like Mike said, you can tell it in the simplest, crudest manner with whatever technology is available to you, whether that be film or video or something on the cutting edge. But if you don't have a story to tell, you don't really have much business doing that. And that's what drives us every day, is that storytelling. Whether it's a $100 million movie with Scorsese, one of the renowned best filmmakers in the world, or doing something with a couple of kids at Columbia that is equally as exciting, I'm sure. I actually find those ones on the lower end of the scale much more exciting. And you actually see the results of your efforts much quicker and much more directly in those pictures. So much of what we do on those bigger pictures is just kind of keep the train from wrecking, as opposed to actually putting it on a more enlightened path. But I think technology is a wonderful thing, and there are people that know so much about it, and I am sort of a confirmed Luddite and don't know that much about it, but I do know that it can really get in the way as much as it can help. And if you don't have a story, and people like Gatz haven't, you know, you haven't hired the right kind of people to get you the stories, you can put all the kind of effects behind it and all the sorts of computer-generated this and that behind it, and you still don't have anything that really does much for the audience. And that's what we're here to, at least as commercial feature filmmakers, that's what we're here to sort of deliver.
Gatz, since we've been talking about stories, since you did, I think, what were you telling me before, like 27 scripts, of which 3 have been produced or something? Yeah. How do you see this? Has it had any effect on the work you're asked to do or the work you want to do? Or?
Well, not yet. I mean, I did all of my work within the studio system. And, you know, everyone says that filmmaking is a collaborative effort, which it is. But in terms of being a writer, the collaboration is rather like the collaboration between the guy who's the private and the guy who's the general. And the writer is essentially the private. In the studio system, the only time the script really feels like it belongs to the writer is when he's doing the first draft and no one has seen it yet. Because the minute you turn it in, they're just endless meetings. And they're often meetings with people who, from the writer's perspective, seemingly know nothing about story. But they're often the colonels and the majors, and everyone has something to say. And the writer takes notes, and maybe they're right, and maybe they're wrong, but the changes have to be made, and if you're not willing to make them, there's always some other, you know, hungry writer just kind of scrabbling around outside the door waiting to come in and take your place. So I would think that having the materials become more accessible, i.e. coming closer to paper and pencil, means that since not so much is at risk and it doesn't cost so much to make a movie, so that everyone's not so frightened about things, that the collaboration would be on a higher level, that people would be willing to say, well, let's keep the writer around right through the whole shoot, and maybe he can help out, you know, because it's not that big a risk. I can see Patrick rolling his eyes like, good God, keep the writer off the set. You know?
No, actually, I enjoy relationships with writers a great deal, and I find him to be quite helpful, unless it's just sort of an unworkable situation between the writer and the director. I find him very helpful to be around and actually have encouraged that. And Richard Friedenberg was with us every day on River Runs Through It, on the set and in the editing room a lot of the time, and was hugely helpful to us. And those relationships are some of the fondest I have. And I have a lot of respect for what writers do. I think they are treated terribly in the business. And I do think that every creative exec that has no experience at all in story sitting there giving notes is abominable. I hate those meetings. I sit in them all the time. They feel a need to say something because it's their job to sit there and pipe up in front of the studio executives. but very rarely do they have anything to do that moves the story forward. They can take it sideways, they can sort of add other pieces to it, but it's not about really sort of helping you get a better film to shoot. But I do find, and I think your point about the budget is a good one, the interference at the studio level, creatively as well as from production, goes up exponentially as the budget goes up. If you're doing a little picture that's lower cost, you can usually duck under the radar and they're not paying that much attention to it. When it gets up into the range that Mike's talking about, although if you have someone like Scorsese, they have a tendency to stay away because that's a very formidable filmmaker. The meddling that goes on increases dramatically as the budget goes up for the writer as well as the entire creative team.
Yeah, the one thing that happens is that after you make your small first movie and four people have gone to see it, the studio unfortunately gives the filmmaker much too much money for the next one, because then if you don't, you come to the set and you're not quite sure what you want to do, there's 14 guys in suits and dark ties saying, "What's happening?" You know? So the real mistake we make is to upgrade young filmmakers or people who are finding their way by giving them way too much money the second and third time out. So that's why it's good to stay under the radar, as Patrick says, and you have much, much more freedom. Also, Stanley Kubrick, when he was looking for money after he had made numerously good movies, went to a studio, and a young executive asked Mr. Kubrick, "Well, what have you done?" And Mr. Kubrick said to the young executive, "You go first." The thing to remember is once you get your script right, even though I take credit and made all the good movies by myself, the truth is that it's a collaborative football team, and there are many important people that a director, as your quarterback, has to harness. After you have your producer as your partner, as your cinematographer, your production designer, your sound man, your first assistant director, your editor. And you got to learn to listen to those people because they're bringing to the table lots of good advice. And if you listen to them, your movie will be better.
Tom Nichol, in terms of commercials and music video and a lot of things you do, how have you seen the technology having an effect?
In terms of actually producing commercials, music videos, the majority of what we do is still done on film. I'd say less than 10% of the work that is shot is actually being shot digitally. But to echo something that Patrick said that I think is really important, and Michael as well, it's the concept. It doesn't matter if it's still photographs or animation or claymation. The concept is what delivers the message, and that's what we focus on as producers in commercial production. For me personally, I have a 14-year-old son who is dying to make his first music video. And because of the digital revolution, I won't have to dip into his college fund. I think, however, the most significant changes in our industry are coming into post-production.
JP Gabriel?
I've worked with Tom on hundreds of commercials over the years, and I'll tell you, I just want to be the authority as to how it affects Montanans. If you ever want to refer to something, I'd love on the technical side, how many jobs do we get out of it, and that kind of thing. Because I can let you know. Once we started shooting plates instead of having actors in front of the mountain scenery that we have here, it cut down a lot of shoot days. We have a lot of green screen effects that happen now that they used to have to go find the location for. So the amount of days that Montanans get out of work because of the digital revolution, it has been decreased. I'll tell you that right now in commercial production. The great thing about it, though, is that it seems like a lot of people are threatened by the fact that, okay, well, now that we have this digital camera and it gets such low light level and it has all these qualities and the high definition and guys can run around with a camera on their shoulder, luckily for me in the lighting business and the support services business, it's still got to look good. I mean, if you want it to look like a documentary, then it'll look like a documentary. But if you want it to look good, you still have to light it nice. You still have to have the contrast ratios. You still have to have a lot of the elements that film gives you on a kind of an easier way. As far as Montanans go, we have seen a major change in how the digital world has affected us on the nuts and bolts scale of commercial production.
Scott Chestnut is our sort of emissary to the editing end of this. Have you seen more of that, more sort of blue screens and things, and how has, because I think some of the earliest digital changes actually came in the editing with Avids and that sort
of thing. Yeah, there's always been a certain amount. I mean, I'm seeing less blue screen and green screen than I used to, but it was more of a stylistic choice before than it is now. You know, the compositing is so great and it's so easy to do now, but if you can shoot a plate for a certain shot, I mean, we were talking about this the other day, shooting one side of a scene in one town and shooting the other side of the scene in another town. That's an imperfect solution, but just to go back for a second, I mean, I hated cutting film. So for the cinematographers who love film, you know, I know how they feel about film. I mean, I love the way film looks, but I hated cutting it. It's so much easier to cut nonlinear stuff. And it's great. The more you can get something in front of you that's inexpensive where you can labor over it for hours without people tapping their watch is great. So the digital revolution in terms of filmmaking, in the end, I mean, if you look at it from the editorial side, which is kind of the downstream side, it's great. It's the best thing that ever happened. Because you get so much more time to cut. And I've known people over the years who came up in the business long before I did, and it wasn't that big of a deal to have a Chem 8 plate in somebody's house somewhere and cut for a year on a movie, you know? And there was a period there where nobody wanted to do that. They wanted to have the movie as soon as possible. And what I think is great about digital video is that it allows people to make films and make films on their own nickel where they're not asking somebody else to pay for it, because that's where people learn. That's where people develop new ideas. A case in point is the movie Memento. No one would make that movie. Suzanne Todd, you know, decided to make that movie because she got the script, but there's very few people in the studio business who would have ever understood what that script was about. And I've had a couple of pictures in development over the years, and I've had meetings with development executives where they didn't even read anything but the dialogue. You know, I mean, they hardly read the whole script because they have 15 scripts to read on a Sunday, and they try to go through all of them, and they, you know, they come into the meeting and you realize that they barely understood the script. So it's no wonder that a movie like Memento could have never gotten made by a studio. And it couldn't get distribution either until Steven Soderbergh got behind it, right? So I think that if you can utilize digital video to your advantage, it's to make short films with it, as many as you can, and as fast as you can on your own nickel, because by the time you've done, you know, 5 or 6 digital shorts, you will have learned enough to make a feature that may be groundbreaking in some way.
Bob Ebinger?
Say something along with what JP was talking about. I know when video came out and there was early on this conflict with film, I constantly heard, or maybe not constantly, but often heard producers say, you know, less people, less time, less lights, you know, and I think there's a misconception there. I mean, to do a good quality production, whether it be digital, whether it be non-digital or film, certain films require certain amount of equipment, certain amount of personnel, and I hate to see quality sacrifice for expediency. And I think sometimes we do see that, or it's a concept that gets battered around into smoke-filled rooms, maybe not smoke-filled rooms anymore, but they have this misconception of exactly what, they have this misconception of what exactly quality needs in all the different forms.
Ron Judkins, you want to?
Yeah, talking around with what I consider to be film professionals, there's like two sides to this digital thing. And actually talking to some of the festival folks, I mean, there's like a lament going around about the fact there's going to be like so many sort of bad digital video movies out. But on the other hand, it sort of opens a door to a lot of experimentation, a lot of sort of learning. I think this is one of the things that Scott brought up. And I think there's a danger of looking at digital video through what I consider to be film eyes, like as a replacement for film. It's not a replacement for film. It's actually a new medium. And I think what really the opportunity for that and what's starting to happen is that with people experimenting with the new medium and playing with it, it's sort of changing what the kinds of films people are making. I see a lot more sort of personal films being made. And slowly it seems like there's a process by which sort of film grammar is changing, because people are having the opportunity to experiment and play and just pushing back the barriers of what's acceptable and what audiences can understand. I think Memento is a good example of that. But I think it's an amazing opportunity for actual change in the way films are made and what films are.
Tom Miller, do you want to comment on some of the work that you do?
I think of Mike Figgis that did Time Code just recently, where he took digital images and put four of them into a regular feature film framework. And the idea was, I think the cameras didn't stop through the entire, it was like one take each one of the four shots. So, but see, he still works out of L.A. This is good. I was down in L.A. and I was, I think, a little bit ahead of the time when I was looking at the Amiga and what it could do with Lightwave. And I went to some of the post houses back in that time, and this is early 80s, and I said, yeah, I see a revolution coming with the PC or with the Amiga. You know, of course, the Amiga didn't quite make it, but... And at that time, it was considered a big joke, so I headed up to Montana. And then I got to do my animation up here. And the sad thing is, some of the stuff I did, they got on CNN in a roundabout way, but people thought it was coming from Silicon Valley. So, you know, Livingston needs to be put on the map, Bozeman, you know, Montana. I think that's one of the things we're really here to try to understand. And MSU is obviously a very crucial part of this whole thing, and it's exciting to see people of the quality and work of Michael Hoffman and Patrick, of course, here with all your wonderful records to kind of give us a jump start, because I think the scripts are important. That's still a crucial thing. I agree with you.
Tina, are we going to have an age where we don't really need live actors? We'll just sort of create them or take old dead actors and resurrect them? And
it has changed it in the fact that casting directors don't fill so many wastebaskets with their many headshots, because now you can get them over the internet. And so it's a good way to market. You know, every job that gets taken away, you have to wonder what happens to those things, because there was a fortune spent in headshots that doesn't get spent anymore. I mean, they can do them at Kinko's, they can do them on their own computers, and then they can just market themselves over the internet, which is very interesting, because it makes my job as a casting director very easy, because I can go anywhere and access actors or faces from any place in the world. So that's been kind of interesting. As far as how I think that this new revolution affects Montana, I think we have to go back to the hand-in-hand with tourism, because as a promoter of Montana for film production, for years I have said it's a working vacation. And I have invited people to come to Montana, and they have come for the mystique of just being here, being able to live here for a while and be part of our communities and shoot with our very natural, beautiful backgrounds. And I think that's where we have to bring that back around. We have to re-invite people for that reason.
Michael Hausman?
I get his headshots. I don't know who they are. Right. The headshot never looks like anybody alive. Right. I mean, people bring their headshots, and then the person comes in and say, who are you? Exactly. Look at these faces. Look at fabulous. You know, I'd put them all in my movies, wouldn't we, Patrick?
Absolutely.
Yeah, let's break early, make a little movie with these people.
Tom, more interesting faces in the local bars or cafes or that sort of thing in towns and in several places here in Montana. When we shot up in Lovina on that very small project I did out of Sundance a number of years ago, so many, because we had so little money, we brought a lot of local people into that, and they were wonderful and very natural in their performances. And the idea of headshots is something that's always annoyed me, because I get flooded with them, as does everybody in the business. And I think that's something that was created more by the photography industry than it was by the acting industry. And I always encourage kids that are trying to break out there as actors to spend the time and the money on acting lessons, working in the theater, developing their craft so they can come into an audition and know what the hell they're doing and have that depth of experience to rely on, as opposed to having been in two plays in high school, get on a bus, go to Los Angeles, get an expensive set of headshots done for a couple grand, and then try to sell yourself as an actor in the most competitive acting pool in the country. Develop the craft, learn what you need to learn about acting, work as an actor wherever you possibly can, and then maybe somebody wants a picture of you on down the road, but don't spend the money developing that whole, that's sort of a scam, actually, that whole thing with
in
headshots.
In fact, isn't it nice it's gone?
And one other thing I'd like to mention relative to MSU is that Scott Chestnut didn't mention it, but he's a frequent collaborator with John Dahl, who was a very successful director in Los Angeles from Billings originally, and a fellow that I've had the pleasure of producing with, and had come out of this program and has gone on to do very well, and is one of the best directors in the city right or in the town right now. And it all started for John right here, with, along with Scott and some other folks out of that same group of people at MSU. But the students that they're cranking out have every bit of ability to rise to the top of this business like anyone else, and we're all here to sort of support that on behalf of the university.
Tom Echol?
I just wanted to add to something that Tina had said, and I've had the pleasure of working with her and JP and Scott. I produced a small film up here in 1993 for HBO, and somehow felt the need to bring a large LA crew into Montana. And I think half the crew are still living here. They fell in love with the environment, the atmosphere, everything, and they've all moved. So now I have to bring them back to LA when I want them to work in LA. Yeah. But I think there is something to the promotion of Montana through the tourism aspect, through the mystique of it. In LA, whenever anyone hears that we're doing a shoot in Montana, they're just standing in line to come up here. So I think that could be a really valuable tool that we could be using. And to kind of bring it back to how can we help here in Montana to improve the film industry, I think there's a tremendous amount of talented people that work in film. And I've got to know most of them through JP and through Tina. And it's something that we need not to be afraid of, that there's an LA production company, and you know, how are the Montana people going to get on it? For me, it's just the opposite. I try and figure out how many Montana people can I put onto a shoot, and how few LA people can I bring, because I don't want to lose them to moving up here anymore.
Joe Camp, since you've worked as an assistant director and also been a director, do you see these things changing? And also, you've done other regional productions, and obviously you come from a family that sort of almost originated the form. Do you want to just comment on how you see some of the changes and how they might also reflect on Montana?
You know, when I made the film, wrote and directed the film that I made about 3 or 4 years ago, the biggest challenge that I had, which was the scariest thing, was to try to find a way to keep it, you know, what we put on the page when we sat down to write the script, you know, because the more people you get involved in the financing level, the studios, you know, you've heard these guys talk about studio meetings, and you've heard Gatz talk about them. They're all, you know, they're almost comical, you know. I mean, we made a love story about, you know, 80-year-olds, you know, a couple of 80-year-olds, and they're telling us, yeah, we'll make your movie, you know, we'll make it with James Woods and 85-year-old makeup, you know, and they're talking about putting a guy through 6 hours of makeup just to make the movie because it fits some demographic that they're trying to fit into. You know, that's what you want. You want your film to look, feel, and smell like the thing that you made, you know, the thing that you wanted to make. You want it to be different. And digital video, I think, offers people the opportunity to not ruin their career, you know, in one movie, you know, because, you know, you don't have to take it to film. You don't have to spend $100,000 in post if it's not any good. And you can see and you can learn from it, you know, and I think that's the biggest thing. You know, I don't think it's going to replace film because, you know, the mini DV movies aren't transferring well enough to have the audiences in America go, that's great. You know, you're not going to see, you know, Sylvester Stallone on a mini DV movie, you know, anytime soon, I don't think, you know, but that's the big thing. I think it's a big avenue.
I'm going to, switch the direction just a little bit here and pick up on a comment Michael made earlier and that Scott Chestnut did about a week ago at a group of alumni that were over at the university. Michael mentioned about how sometimes young filmmakers will make a film, you know, maybe on DV or whatever, and then all of a sudden they're given a ton of money, and instead of having like 15 of their friends making the film with them, they have 150 or 200 people who stand around and look at them and say, you know, what do I do next? And Scott, when he was on that other roundtable, mentioned that, you know, film schools and film training can only teach you so much. They can give you the skills, but they can't teach you the politics. They can't teach you the protocols. Panel has, you know, years, probably, you know, centuries of experience altogether in terms of feature films and documentaries, too, because they have their own protocols. So I would like to sort of deal with that. What are the sorts of things that you really can teach and almost have to be learned by going out and doing it, and how can, let's say, people in Montana trying to work on films who may not have that experience kind of absorb it or at least learn about it? See, everybody's afraid to talk about that one. Well, let me switch over. Rick, if you want to talk a little bit, you've done, you know, so many different documentary films with different organizations. What has that been like?
I'm trying to relate to our students the importance of really two things, and that's passion and patience. And that's going to get you a long ways. And we have I think in our society, we don't want to take the time. We don't want to have an apprenticeship to learn the craft, and it's particularly in science and wildlife where we've got pretty much some of these masters that have been shooting natural history programs around the world, and a young generation that doesn't want to really learn from them. And it, I think two things will get you in the door, and that is if you're apprenticing and that patience that you show and that passion you bring for your craft, whatever tool you're working with, and that's going to get you, you know, a lot more than, oh, I've got a great idea, here's my film, you've got to go with it. Believe me, that the Discovery Channel, National Geographic, BBC has thousands of scripts and story ideas sitting on desks, the same in the feature world, and that there are a number of people doing those films because they've come through and they have the track record.
Anybody? Yeah, Joe?
I think one of the things about, you know, when you're in creative meetings with studios and you're dealing with the politics of that, fight them 90% of the time because they're wrong most of the time. And then when you're in the group of filmmakers, like Mike said, you're making a film with, you know, 150, 200 people, you know, don't fight them so hard because they're involved with your film. And 90% of the time, they've got a point that you haven't thought of because you get, you know, you're so focused on the minutia of the day-to-day events of, you know, and you get away from the big picture a little bit, you know. But the studio, you know, they'll sit there and they'll talk to you, and they honestly will not have read the script, you know. They'll come into meetings and they'll talk to you all about when they're going to release it and what it's going to be and how it's got to be a Christmas movie when it's an Easter movie because we can demographically justify it, you know.
Yesterday, the issue of distribution came up a lot. And I wanted to find out from the people who are actually making the films, you know, how much that influences, you know, what people are doing when you're actually doing it, which it obviously does, in terms of, you know, affecting your creativity or the decisions. And that also impacts, obviously, the technology issues.
But flashing green is maybe the movie's going, and then when it's a green light, the picture's greenlit. It's usually never greenlit by the creative, so-called creative people at the studios. It's greenlit by the marketing and distribution people, because you'll take your director, they'll take who's in it, and then they go around the 75 territories around the world and say, we can get so much from Japan, so much from Germany, so much from France, and if it adds up to what your picture costs, you'll get the picture made. It has nothing to do with anything else unless you're smart enough to make it small and under their radar. Pat?
Yeah, Mike's absolutely right. The marketing departments at the studios totally drive the decision-making, and that's a real unfortunate trend in the business since the big corporations have taken over the studios in the last 5 or 6 years. Marketing, they want a one-sheet before they want to see the script. They want to know what the poster is going to look like. That becomes the impetus behind it, as opposed to allowing us as filmmakers to create and produce the best movie we can, and then taking some initiative on their part to figure out how to market it. They want to know what the marketing thing is going in. And if you can get Brad Pitt, and you can get Martin Scorsese, and you can get a script by a supposedly A-list writer, they will greenlight that picture based on that, not necessarily because it is a good story or a good script, but because there is a marketing concept behind it. And that is one of the biggest problems with the industry. They want to sell movies like they sell cereal or cigarettes or whatever the other commodities are that these Fortune 50 companies that own the studios also market. They want that shelf space in the grocery store. They want the opening weekend in the theater in exactly the same way. Movies are not commodities like that. They need to be commercially considered, and I'm very much into making movies that make money. I don't mean to say that, but they cannot be considered in the same breath as those other products that those companies are used to selling, and they're trying to sell movies exactly the same way. And all of us, as creative people on movies, are in service to the marketing department, and that is really unfortunate, because I've always figured that if we are creative and work very hard on what we're doing, that there should be people that are equally as hardworking and equally as creative at the marketing end of it to figure out how to take that picture and convince an audience that they need to see it, or let an audience know that it's coming out. If you have Brad Pitt and Scorsese and a good script, or a decent script by a big writer, and you put that movie in 3,000 theaters the opening weekend and spend $15 or $20 million rolling it out, you probably have a good weekend. But where is the expertise in coming to that decision? It doesn't involve much at all. That's sort of a game that they're trying to reduce they're trying to leverage themselves into a position of protecting their downside by making these huge tentpole movies that they figure will have an opening weekend, because it's all been about opening weekend. You go get your car filled up with gas, the guy putting the gas in your car knows what movies did last weekend at the box office. What is that about? I mean, why do people even care what movies are generating in the way of revenue? People that aren't in the film business. But the fact that that's all common knowledge and people on the national news talk about what movies generate on opening weekend makes it this sort of competitive, marketing-driven experience that it never was really meant to be. And I don't know quite how to change that, but it's a very frustrating thing for us. And as Mike said, if you can show you can sell those territories with that package, the content of that package isn't really as important, what the story is about, as the those elements that you bring together, you can make your movie. And that's at the studio. That's why the move, I think, it needs to be towards more independent financing, venture capitalists, and people that are interested in funding pictures that are about something, and sort of reinvent that entire process and sort of pull it back from the marketing people. We had River Run Through It financed originally by Carolco, which was a company that was very active in Los Angeles at one time, made a lot of money in the sort of Sylvester Stallone action picture genre. They were the ones that originally stepped up to that, I think primarily because they wanted a relationship with Redford. It was sort of a prestigious small movie. They funded it, and while we were in pre-production, I think 6 or 7 weeks away from starting to shoot, already on location, they went bankrupt or something imploded inside, and they decided that they weren't going to make the movie. We were devastated by that because we were prepared to go with it. We had a very reasonable budget, but nobody was stepping up to that movie. We shopped it literally overnight to most of the studios. All of them turned it down. And Jake Eberts, who was a fellow from originally from Toronto or Montreal, but lives in Paris, but an international financier, ran Goldcrest for a while, which was a distribution company in the Far East. Very smart guy and a wonderful guy, and makes terrific movies, has a real heart for the right kind of pictures. He had a relationship with Redford. We contacted him just sort of on a flyer, and literally within 72 hours, he put the financing for that together through an independent consortium. We got the picture shot, and then waited until we finished it, and then shopped it around and showed it once again to all the majors, Miramax, Disney. Everybody looked at that, and finally Columbia decided that they could do something with it and bought it from us, and at a very reasonable price, and then obviously went on to great success with it. But it was a difficult process. But one thing that was nice about Jake funding that picture is that we were pretty much left alone, and Redford was able to make the movie that he wanted to make, and there is a singular vision, I think, expressed in that movie that does not show the sort of committee process that so often movies break down into today, because we were able to make it stay completely under the radar because it was our own money, and also we were making it at a very reasonable cost, and then took a picture around that was essentially complete and shopped it to people and said, are you interested or not? And it was something that a lot of, I must say, a lot of people that, and I sat there in screening rooms with the heads of the studios, I took it around myself, and they looked at it and said, oh, nice movie, kind of interesting, that's fly fishing, what's that all about? Oh, that's Montana, that's pretty nice looking. But they didn't step up. And then two executives at Columbia, I think it must have had something where it touched them sort of on that familial relationship or the brother relationship or something, but these two executives, Mark Canton and Michael Nathanson, both really responded to that, and that's how it ended up over there. So it was a battle all the way through, but you can see by fighting for something like that, you end up with something that's really worthwhile. So you have to keep up that battle on behalf of those pictures, because that's what makes it pay off.
Bill Neff.
Oh, is he here? I was wondering, I'm always intrigued about a good script. What is it? What do you look for when you're reading scripts? And that touches you and says, hey, boy, this is a good script. Any takers?
That's almost as bad as protocol response. Boy, these guys are very careful.
When I read a script, I really want something that compels me to turn the page and to continue to read it. I read a lot of fiction as just for pleasure, and I really enjoy reading, and I enjoy reading good writing, and I really am as thrilled with scripts as I am with a decent novel or a short story or something like that. But I need to be compelled by the story or the sort of the emotional impact. And that doesn't mean to say it has to be heavily weighted material. It just needs to I need to respond to that on some level, and then from there look at whatever the other sort of plot devices are and things like that. But I need, for a script to really get to me, I need to be able to connect with it on some emotional level, and then have a desire to kind of want to turn the page and see where it's going. So I need that kind of primary response to the writing before I start looking for the gags or the setups and see sort of how to hook the picture or sell somebody on the movie. Mike, you read a lot of them.
Well, I think a couple of the Mamet movies I did, House of Games and Things Change, we picked the city that had the best fish restaurants. On a serious level, is this something that you want to be part of you? Because, I mean, it's like a marriage, and it's like a child, you know. I have three children, and I can't have favorites, and I've had, I don't know, number of movies, and people always ask me, what's your favorite? You know, it's very hard to say. But for me, it just has to be about something that's going to make the world better or make people better, that grips you and that has something to say. You know, actors are always bringing me what I call hunchback movies. That's movies that, you know, they're hunched up in some cave or something, and all they get to do is improv with three of their crazy friends, you know. The nice thing about digital video is you can give them the camera and say, come back with the movie, you know. we all have good stories in us, you know, but it's not always the first story you think of. Sometimes with my students, just you have to read the newspaper. I mean, they're just amazing kinds of stories. Like in New York, I just read an article before I came out about a man who has those homing pigeons, and he has a club of homing pigeons, and they're like lots of homing pigeon people, you know. And they're, you know, not the ones that zoom down and hit your car. I'm talking about the homing pigeons, you know, that they'd send 300 miles away. And then they track him. I mean, you know, can you imagine Robert De Niro, you know, with his homie? I mean, they're just, it's just a great story. I want to make that movie. If you would just write that for me, I would produce it. So they're just great stories, just around, you know, your grandmother or, you know, everybody in here has a good story. You have 10 stories that I'll throw out, but I guarantee you there's one in there that you have that's going to be worth telling.
Also, we talk to writers a lot. They are always selling ideas or bringing stuff, especially beginning writers, and I really encourage them to write what they know. So often someone will come in with some grandiose idea that's based on another movie or a series of movies and sort of an amalgamation of things they've seen and present that as a script. And I think the best way to tell a story effectively is to tell something that you know to begin with and really go from material and from a place of strength with your experience, and then from there you can always branch out into whatever sort of writing you want to do. But so often I read scripts that are just way beyond the person's capability to tell that story, and they've chosen that as opposed to something that might be much more interesting, like something like the homing pigeons. I'm always reading the newspaper and magazines and finding stories in there and throwing them in a file.
Why don't you try and get that story?
We'll do it together, Mike. We've always wanted to work together. Maybe it's the homing pigeon movie.
From the other end of it, yeah, so when sometimes you're asked, obviously, to write a script, but when you're doing an original script, how do you decide what subject you think is going to make a film script as opposed to a novel, because you also are a novelist? Well, you know, how do you make those distinctions?
I've never done an original script on spec. I had a few things to say, because I came to it obliquely. I was a fiction writer, and I was invited to come down and work on scripts. And at the time, I was earning a living writing magazine articles, and because if you're trying to write literary fiction, it's not a good way to support a family. And then when I discovered that even a low-budget movie paid about 100 times more than any magazine article, it became very inviting. And I remember when I got my first shot, which was in the middle, early 70s, at writing a script, my neighbor was Richard Brautigan, and he came over and said, "Well, Gatz," he said, "you know the secret to writing screenplays, don't you?" And I said, "No, Richard, what is it?" He said, "Well, you have to leave all the writing out." And the truth is, it's somewhat the opposite, because there's so many people. I mean, there are people in L.A. you know, who are waiters and cab drivers, and everyone's got a script. They're all working on scripts because they see it as a way, you know, the open door to a big pile of dough, I guess. And so they don't really care about it as a project with, or a in a literary sense, or in a sense, in a story sense. They just are seeing the pot of gold at the end of this rainbow. And the truth is that, you know, they are written. And the better written they are, I mean, Patrick just, you know, he wants it to turn the page. So it helps to be able to, you know, even if it's just the description of the parking lot, if you can say that in a way that's fresh, that will keep the reader going forward, well, then it helps to have some sense of story structure and narrative and character development that's based on writing fiction. I remember someone once, you know, when I hitchhiked out to Hollywood when I was in college, my roommate's father was Tennessee Ernie Ford's music director. So I got out there, and there was a kind of, you know, showbiz quality that which I didn't know anything about it. But I remember this guy's father laughing about some friend of theirs who was a screenwriter, and he was griping about all of the problems he was having at the studio. And some executive said, "Yeah, well, he can always go down to Mexico and sweat out a novel." If you have sweated out a novel and made a novel work, I think that writing a screenplay then, it literally is so much simpler. The only restrictions are is that there's a budget and that it has to kind of get over in 95 pages. You know, you have to tell your story, you know, in a compact and a visual manner. But once you figure that out, hey, this is about telling a story in pictures, and you can write and, you know, put a narrative together, it's that much easier. And the last two things I guess I'll say is, one, for me it was a great advantage to be a novelist, because I had something I really cared about that was at the core of my life. And so then when I did these scripts, if it didn't happen, it wasn't like the end of the world. I always had fiction, that's what I did. And what I did to kind of earn a living was I took jobs, not that I didn't ever try, I put my own name on these things. So I didn't ever want to just turn in something that was, you know, even if it was a car chase movie, I thought, I'm going to make this the most clever car chase movie that anyone has ever seen. At least that was my attempt. So if you're going to be Woody Allen and you direct your own films, well, then you're a director too. And you're not just the writer and getting clobbered in meetings. You know, you have this sense that that you have something you can believe in. And now my final last thing, I'm going to throw in and then I'll shut up, is that there was a book that came out, the Sid Fields book that came out about 20 years ago. And I think it's ruined a lot of the film production and the point of view, in which he said that, you know, hit films have a three-act structure and that there are these plot points and da-da-da-da-da. This is a man who himself has never been able to write a successful screenplay, but he came up, he based it on Casablanca, and the whole thing is about the way the Casablanca works. Well, fine, that's the way Casablanca works, but is that the way A River Runs Through It works? Is that the way La Dolce Vita worked? I mean, some scripts have nine acts or three acts. I mean, but you cannot go into a meeting. Every executive in Hollywood has read this book, and they want to know, well, what's your plot point one, and where's your second act break? And, you know, and that's the way they see it now. And so it's been straitjacketed into this form, and I think it's very, very inhibiting to a storyteller to feel they have to, you know, hammer it into that form when it doesn't need to be that way, because in the hands of a gifted director and gifted actors, it can have 20 acts and work.
I think it was William Goldman said one time that almost anyone can write a screenplay and almost no one can write one well. And it's a very tricky medium to try to, you say, oh, 100 pages, I got a story to tell, and people sit down. People come to me all the time and say, what computer program should I buy to write a screenplay on? And I said, writing a screenplay is not about the computer you use or the program you use or the format. If you put it in whatever format you want to, if it's a good story, I'll read it. And if it's not, no matter how well it's paginated and how perfect it comes out of the computer, it does not make the story.
In terms of story, and this maybe is for Thomas Scott, I know that very often you're dealing with things like commercials and music videos. I think Scott used a phrase once about directors who wave the camera at what's going on, and they're, you know, you get it, and you're not sure there is any, you know, you basically you become a kind of post-script writer. Do you want to talk about what that's like when either, you know, a script goes astray somewhere in production and, you know, you have to, quote, you know, fix it in post, or, you know, you have to find the film, I think is one of the other phrases people use.
So that's exactly what we look for. We look for the editor to save the job. So falls in the scouts.
Oh, okay. Let me just say one thing about scripts. It does help if it's formatted correctly, because then you have a better chance of getting it made, because I get sent just pieces of crap all the time. I get sent from my agent, I get the script and I get a little card that says, you know, what actors are going to be in the movie. And sometimes you can't get 10 pages into it. It's so bad. So there is hope, you know. I mean, if you have a really terrible story, it could get made. So go ahead and type it out. Go for it, because, you know, because Amanda Peet might be in it, you know. There's not one project I've ever worked on that didn't need an overhaul in the editing process. And that doesn't mean there was something wrong with it. What it means is that when you write a script, how it works on the page is not necessarily how it's going to work when people are saying the lines and when people are moving through it. And the thing that never ceases to amaze me in movies, and it's probably one of the most exciting things about it, is how you, as an audience, how the audience can invest in what's going on in the screen and actually add more to it than really was ever intended to be there. One thing that's happened, I think, on several movies that I've worked on is that there's some very delicate moment that is going to happen that the producers or other people involved with the picture haven't even realized yet, because they're so familiar with the project. And it is until they get it in front of the audience and people start responding to it that they realize that that's even there, or realize that they can embellish that. So editing a movie is a dynamic process, and you know, hopefully you're working with a director who's a genius, and so that is a lot easier. Editorial isn't the whole answer, but it's part of it. And I sure wish I was working with Martin Scorsese sometimes, I'll tell you that.
Brian Judkins.
Back in the days when you would cut film, it took a long time. And you would, like, cut a scene, you'd go home, you'd think about it. You might think about it over the weekend. You come back on Monday, you see it with fresh eyes. Well, it's so quick to actually cut a movie now that I think some of that time that might have been spent in thought process is kind of lost. Right. But I think, as a filmmaker, it was an important thing for me to realize that once your film is cut, forget about what the script was or what your three-act structure, whatever it is, your film will be found or it won't be found in the editing process. And that was a very valuable thing for me to learn.
Can I just add one thing? In Sidney Lumet, I've never worked with Sidney Lumet, but I read his book. And one of the things he talked about was how when he did a movie, he always let every scene, every line of dialogue have their day. In other words, they would cut the movie together with everything in it. And they wouldn't eliminate anything until they'd at least seen it on the screen with the whole movie. And then they would go in and start working on reels and trying to decide what they were going to keep and what they weren't going to keep. On all the stuff that I've worked on, we've always kind of followed that same Sidney Lumet approach, which is let everything have its day in court before it's eliminated or executed. There's a lot of movies out there right now that are cut way too fast, and I don't mean the speed of, well, the editorial process is really shrunken. Sure. trying to make a release date, which I've also been through that nightmare. The preview cycle, just trying to make enough changes to make the next preview, and then keep doing that until you finish the movie. So you never get a chance to really consider the shape the movie is in.
Michael Hausman?
One of the keys, too, is preparation on a movie. Now, Marty on Gangs of New York took 20 years. That's a little bit too long. It's very cheap dollars to prep your movie. You have very few people on, and you can get all the elements you need on the train to take it from one station to the other. Once you start shooting your movie, there should be some incentive to eventually finish it.
Yeah, I want to switch a little bit. We've been talking about story primarily in terms of dramatic films or fiction films. Documentaries have stories, too. And to the documentary people here, how do you know that something's going to make a decent documentary, or at least you think it is, especially since you usually don't know exactly what you're going to be shooting?
You want me to address that?
That may be Bob.
Well, I think it's just that first... Certainly that first page, too, and it's a campfire story, and it sounds good. One thing that we're trying to pass on is that in natural history and science, where we have this great planet, and we've got stories everywhere and engaging people, and yet our obstacles are coming these last couple of years. We've gone through a real dark period, and that's that the pundits believe that they need reality. They need wrestling from escapees from Australian mental institutions to chase down and wrestle every alligator and crocodile. And that carried over to the whole industry, The BBC took some courage to say, no, we're not going to do that. But that affected everything we're doing in storytelling, that you had to have those moments in there, those authored moments where you jump off the truck. And I thought we did that 30 years ago with Big Jim, but that's a thing we're battling right now. And to have the courage to say, okay, we've done that. That's not the genre. We're supposed to have some style on our storytelling, and we're bringing something special to the planet and to the audience, and to have the courage to say, I don't make those kind of films.
That hasn't happened in Hollywood yet.
And that concludes tonight's program, a panel discussion called The Inside Story, The Art, Craft, and Business of Filmmaking. This discussion was held in Livingston, Montana on October 20th and featured William Yorstberg, Joe Camp, Bob Ebinger, Tina Buckingham, Bill Neff, Patrick Markey, Michael Hausman, Dennis Egg, Tom Mickel, Scott Chestnut, Ron Judkins, Jim Abel, J.P. Gabriel, Tom Miller, John Buckland, and Rick Rosenthal. I want to thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Yellowstone Public Radio, and I'm Susan DeCamp.